So let me say a little bit less about the long history of Nyingma. It's so old. The Nyingma, of course, means the old tradition. But the reason is that I want to spend more time with Mipham, and just maybe, well, so I'll say some things generally, and then we'll look at a couple of figures briefly, and we'll talk a little bit about Dzogchen practice so you have, like, some idea. But then I want to spend, like, a larger part of the time than usual, like, focusing on Mipham's thought in particular. And I think we'll see why. The Nyingma tradition, according to the Nyingma tradition, goes back to teachings that came directly from Buddhas to someone who lived in the first century, 2,000 years ago, and then that person passed it on to somebody else, and passed it down to somebody else, and then eventually in that lineage there was somebody named Vimalamitra who came to Tibet was part of the first transmission of the Dharma and produced translations at the request of King Tisong Detsen. Even though all that is so, it doesn't get very much attention really compared to Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava is like, his life story is told over and over, but, in one way of telling the origins of Nyingma, he's a person in this lineage, not the originator of the lineage, but a person in this lineage that goes back hundreds of years before him. But he obviously becomes the preeminent person in the lineage, and there's so many, like, stories. Of course, Padmasambhava is called Guru Rinpoche, and he's like a major figure of worship, devotion in Nyingma and by others as well. And I've mentioned him briefly the other day when we were, I remember what we were talking about, Buddhism coming to Tibet or something. The idea that Tibet was full of demons in the 8th century. It's like, and so it was difficult for the Dharma to become established there. And that Padmasambhava, who'd already been spreading the Dharma in China and Turkestan, according to the tradition, was asked to come to Tibet and clear out some of these obstacles because Shantarakshita was having difficulty going to Tibet because of the, these kinds of obstacles. And so Padmasambhava went and was able to go around and amaze everyone by clearing away these forces that were obstructing Buddhism coming in. I wonder about what that looked like, if you were there. I've thought about it and there's demons and he's clearing them away. But, then they say Padmasambhava cleared all the demons out of Tibet, and then I think, well, did they come back, or why why do they need protectors, and why do they do other kinds of rituals to ward us? So maybe he cleared them away provisionally or something, or maybe he cleared away some particularly bad ones. I don't. That's a little bit unclear. But then I always think that there's another level of this that you get sort of that maybe this has to do with actual humans who are not wanting Buddhism to come and displace them as the religious leaders, so the people who we come to call, burned. But of course they weren't burned then, they just become that later in relationship to Buddhism being established. So whatever was there was obviously something there before Buddhism, and there were people resistant to it. So, I was thinking a little bit about how Buddhism succeeded in one part of its history in China. It occurred to me that these could have been like sort of magic contests, you know, feats, like, you know, Shantarakshita wasn't going to do any super, super normal feats, but, you know, Padmasambhava could go head to head with the shamans who were there, you know, and show that, you know, there was real power involved in this teaching, and then that would make it possible for more of a scholar abbot type to come in, like Shantarakshita. Anyway, that's the way. I not only think of it that way, but I think we're sort of intended to think about it at least partially that way, but not necessarily that that's the only level of meaning. And so anyway, I just like making this, when we were talking at lunch, or making reference to this idea of different ways of teaching. I mean, one of the ideas, there's lots of different ideas about the way teaching is transmitted in Nyingma, and one of them is called these three lineages, that there's a thought lineage, a sign lineage, and a word lineage. And so teachers in Nyingma just don't teach. There's not like a priori assumption that the teacher will be teaching by explaining things or using words. There's the thought lineage is like the idea that one way teachers teach is that they transmit their awakening into the mind of their students. And another way is by signs and gestures, but what that's taken to mean like doing something dramatic and unexpected that like breaks the person out of their habitual way of looking at things. So when Trungpa Rinpoche was explaining this, apparently he gave the example of a Talopa smacking Naropa in the face with a shoe, with his shoe, you know. And so this idea is that, like, not just like a certain mudra or something with your hand, but more like a whack upside the head when you were least expecting it. Anyway, that's what I'm getting. Yeah. It's like makes me think of the Chan tradition again in terms of some other ways of teaching. But anyway, of course, then there's also the one that we're more familiar with, where you actually use language. That's for the people with the lowest capacity. Anyway, you know, there's a lot of other kinds of ways that teaching is known and that we don't have to get into, but are distinctive to Nyingma, like the Terma tradition. But so let's just say, let's go quickly into just saying basically the distinctive kind of practice that's associated with Nyingma is Dzogchen. And Dzogchen is like, you know, means, that's a Tibetan word, it means, you know, Dzog is completion or perfection. Chen is just great, like the Maha and Mahayana. So what is that in Sanskrit? I haven't found out. People use it as the equivalent of Ati Yoga, which is the highest of the. There's all these different like classes of Nyingma vehicles, and then within that, all different classes of tantric vehicles and high tantric vehicles, and the highest thing is this Ati Yoga. And Ati Yoga does not translate into Tibetan as Dzogchen, but that's what they consider that Dzogchen is this Ati Yoga practice. Okay, Ati Yoga, you know, yoga obviously is Nenjor in Tibetan, not Dzogchen. So I'm not sure how that came to have that name in Tibetan. It's kind of an interesting question. Yeah. So anyway.
Maybe it was a term.
Oh, well, that's possible. Yes, they definitely do. You know, Anne Klein has written about this Burn Dzogchen. And, right, you know, it's very difficult to sort out, you know, what comes from where. You know, when you see this is a lineage that Nyingma understands as coming from, like, the first century AD in India, but then it's very similar to what the Burns are saying, you know, that they have within their own tradition. So somebody's been influenced by somebody, it seems like, maybe. So anyway, you know, in this practice of Dzogchen, you find a description of it in a. So you have these like various tantric texts that are part of the first transmission that Nyingma uses, and these tantras are different from many of the tantras that come in the second transmission, and that leads to a lot of arguing, you know, about who has the right tantras and, you know, whether the Nyingma tantras are really even tantras. And you know, there is clear that, like, there's some of the translations. I think you can say that the translations that were done in the first transmission were looser. And Nyingma considers that good, you know, that this was like, these were getting at the heart of what was being said, not being like scholarly and pedantic. And the later transmissions are very, the later translations are much tighter and more systematic in the way they work. So whether that means that the earlier translations were bad or good, it just maybe you like a freer translation, I don't know. But then along with that, there's the issue of the texts themselves. I mean, they have different tantras than come later on. Maybe reflecting just what was, you know, like maybe the, just what kinds of texts were available in India from whichever part of India, you know, was sending people to Tibet at a given time. That's what I think of it as anyway. But anyway, so they have this tantra called the Tantra of the Great Natural Arising of Awareness. That states that all the other tantras that use images or visualizations are inferior to Dzogchen, because Dzogchen works with the mind itself. And just to give you a sense of what that means, here's some of that tantra. Because you yourself are the divine mandala, naturally manifest to yourself, do not offer worship to a deity. For if you worship, you will be fettered by it. And do not renounce samsara, for if you renounce it, you will not attain Buddhahood. Because the Buddha is not elsewhere, he is nothing but awareness itself. And samsara is nowhere else. It is all gathered within your own mind. Do not practice conditioned virtues, for if you do, you will be fettered by them. Renounce conditioned fundamental virtues such as building stupas and temples. And there is no end to contrived doctrines. But by leaving them, they will end. And so it goes on like in that vein. And so then the idea is like, well, you know, I was thinking of this, and I was like, Zen, he does thinking of this in the spirit of, you know, the story about Bodhidharma going to take the transmission of Chan, and like the emperor wants to know how much merit he's gotten for all the patronage he's been giving to Buddha, and Bodhidharma says, none whatsoever, right? I said, well, this isn't exactly the same idea, right? Anyway, that's the way I take it. But it could, you know, one of the things here is like, aside from what it's saying about, you know, not being attached to certain kinds of conventional Buddhist pieties, I could say, there's also this idea that you're not going to be visualizing a deity in front. You're not going to be making offerings to that deity. You are going to be simply focusing on recognition of yourself as Buddha and your environment as the Pure Land of that Buddha, right? And so some of the language that they use in talking about this, Dzogchen involves cultivating a union of essential purity and spontaneity, and sometimes they also use this word equality. So essential purity we could interpret, all right, and then later it is interpreted within the Nyingma as meaning that the fundamental purity from the very things from the very beginning is that, like what they mean by emptiness, right? Of course, it could also mean in a more direct way, you know, being pure, fundamentally pure from the very beginning of any of the impurities associated with samsara. That, you know, and that this is one of the important concepts in many of the tantras, right, is that of having, oh, that's what it's called, the Pure Land, because it's, right, it's, and so it's like if it's fundamentally pure, like a Pure Land from the very beginning, that's the idea. And so you could take it that way, or you could say this fundamental purity, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't look like a pure land. In what sense is it fundamentally pure? Oh, in the sense that its fundamental nature is devoid of any essence of not being a pure land, right? It's essentially pure of being obstructed from being a pure land from the very beginning. Because of what? It's empty, right? But they don't talk in the early Nima, you know, or always so much about emphasizing emptiness, and they certainly don't talk about reasoning your way into understanding emptiness. Okay, that's important. So according to Dzogchen, all positive qualities then from within this primordial purity are spontaneously established in the sense that they are manifested from the fundamental mind, which is also identified with the mind basis of all, the alaya. When sentient beings realize the natural purity of the fundamental mind basis, then they attain Buddhahood. And when they fail to, they wander in cyclic existence. And that's the only difference, because they're always fundamentally pure and they're always spontaneously manifesting, you know, one way or the other. And then they have this concept that was somebody mentioned yesterday of cutting through or breaking through. And that involves the experience of directly seeing what's appearing right now as directly seeing right now the this fundamentally primordially pure mind. Like, our minds are primordially pure from the very beginning, and that's like always present with us as we're experiencing anything moment to moment. But we're cut off, you know, from our delusion, from seeing that fundamentally pure mind that's there. So cutting through or breaking through means cutting through to seeing that fundamentally pure mind that's always there all the time. And then they have a related word, a leap over or direct approach. Some people translate it as tergel, which is sort of the other side. If you take that as the ultimate side, then the conventional side is recognizing that phenomena that are appearing moment by moment are the spontaneous appearances from this fundamentally pure mind. So recognizing the nature of the fundamentally pure mind that's cutting through, and then recognizing the appearances that arise from that as is spontaneously arising from that fundamental purity, that's called leap over or a direct approach. That spontaneity is the word they use about the arising of things from the mind. And you know that they talk a lot about the distinction between mind, like ordinary mind, that's mind, and then what, the nature of mind or knowledge, different words are used, pure awareness. Okay, so sem in Tibetan is like just ordinary mind, but semmi, like the nature of mind, mindness, actually literally, that is like the fundamental nature of the mind, and that's what we're trying to see. We're trying to see the mindness of the mind, the essential mindness of the mind, and that essential mindness of the mind is also called Rigpa in Tibetan, which means it's like this. Some people say knowledge, but that's so misleading. So you could say, like, you know, basic awareness or fundamental awareness aspect. So this mind itself, the semni, the mindness of the mind, that is the Buddha mind. And so that's like what we're talking about in the Uttaratanta Shastra. That's our Tathagata Garbha, in effect. Okay. So Dzogchen, though, because it's like the highest of the highest of the highest sort of vehicle, then it's really supposed to be only for a very small number of spiritually advanced practitioners who have an unusually high capacity to... The idea is that they say this is like something that's always right here with us. It's like, I'm reminded of that, like, saying in Islam that, you know, God is closer to you than your throat. And it's like that. Like, it's not anywhere else. You know, it's always here, right? So they say one of the difficulties is that it's too close, that it's too simple, and at the same time, it's too profound and inconceivable. And because of these problems, like, most people just can't get it, right? That's the idea. You have to do a lot of, even though it should be extremely simple, in practice it's not. And those are the ways they talk about, like, well, why it's not so simple. Oh, they say, I was like doing the Islam version, but like, oh, they say in Nyingma, it's closer to you than your heart or your breath. It's more fundamental to who you are than any of your emotions or your feelings or experiences, because it's the basic nature of all of us all the time. You're experiencing anything. So in order to practice, of course, one of the things that you have to do is like calm your mind down and go into like a clear state of mind where you can then try to observe the basic nature of the mind itself as it's arising. And people do this, they, you know, they do practice mindfulness meditation, but as they practice mindfulness meditation, they're trying to penetrate, you could say, almost if I'm using insight-like language, trying to penetrate into what the nature of the thing is, instead of just, like in mindfulness, you would notice it, and you notice it, and maybe label it, or just notice it, what quality was arising with it, and then let it go, so that you can see the next thing, right?
Not necessarily. That's more of Mahasayadaw.
Technique, yeah.
But, you know, standard Theravada, mindfulness, and wisdom go together, and so you're actually using mindfulness to penetrate the nature of the object.
So you have to like stop and to analyze like one particular experience. So suppose I'm doing mindfulness and I'm walking and I have sensations in my feet, right? Like if I'm going to start like, I have to start like trying to penetrate analytically into the nature of a tiny sensation. Of pressure?
You're noticing the thing, but you're also looking at its impermanent nature, its nature of dukkha, its selflessness.
Oh, the three marks.
Yeah.
So you're like trying to bring to mind and see how the three marks are present in the phenomena as they're arising.
Right. This is kind of the thing that mindfulness is just you note something and draw. But that's from Mahasayadaw, and it's a very American thing. It's not standard.
No, I always thought we were going to watch things as they arose, and then sooner or later we would notice the three marks in them. But you're saying we're actually setting out to look at perceive the three marks as they're there. Oh, I see. Okay, thank you. Yeah. So in this case, you're looking not for the three marks, which would lead you to turn away from these things, but you're looking in to see their basic fundamental nature, which is who you are and who everything is in your experience, right? So that's still a very different kind of thing. And so in this kind of looking into what mind is, there's, and this is important in the Dalai Lama's thing that I was doing last year, part of the process is to try to look at the character and the quality of the mind, what kinds of qualities it has, and also how it arises and abides and pass away. So there's this kind of like, oh, now you're doing some kind of analysis, but it's not like a reasoned, logic-based analysis. It's more of a kind of introspective empiricism, you know. You're trying to say, well, what is actually going on here with the moment of my experience? What is it like? How minds arise and pass away. You're searching for the place from which the mind arises, checking various parts of the body and realizing that none of them is suitable as a basis for the arising and so forth. Or, you know, and trying to catch the moment in which something starts and so forth. So His Holiness, this is very important in his analysis of this, because he's saying, well, you know, they may not call this analytical meditation, but what they're going to do from, you know, my point of view is adding up to realizing through analysis that the mind is unfindable under analysis, even if they're not doing it in the same way that, right? You're searching for, trying to find some graspable nature of the mind and finding that it's unfindable. Because you realize that the mind arises from nowhere, abides nowhere, and goes nowhere. And this leads to the understanding that the mind is empty. And one final thing I wanted to say about this experience of like this process of like checking out what the mind is like, and it relates a little bit to a passage we might get to in Nipam. one Nyingma teacher has this sort of poem. Mind has no form, no color, or concrete substance, and is not found anywhere outside or within your body. It's not a concrete thing, even if you search the 10 directions. It does not arise from anywhere or abide anywhere or disappear at any place. But that doesn't mean it's non-existent. It's not non-existent. Since your mind is vividly awake, it's not a singularity because it manifests in manifold ways. Nor is it a plurality because all these are of one nature. There is no one who can describe its nature. But when expressing what it is like, there is no end to what can be said, and ends all of the enigma text, right? It is the very basis of samsara and nirvana. That's like I'm reading this and I'm like, well, you know, it's not one and it's not many. Oh, that's like what it reminds me of Nagarjuna, right? And then he's saying, like, wherever you search for it, there, like you search in this place, or this place, or this place, like you're not going to find it. But nonetheless, it's that doesn't refute its existence because it's immediately apparent. Right? It's a different kind of, maybe, you know, feel that this is a different kind of language we're talking about, getting a different kind of way of getting at something similar to, you can get it in different ways. Okay, so on my sheet that A Religion gave, some names relevant to Tibetan Madhyamaka, I picked two people to say a little bit about. And the second two are very famous. And the first one is not so famous, but he's the earliest one. So we'll start with him. Rongzom Chögyi Sangbo. Rongzom, people call him Rongzomba. Rongzomba was like, is important here for us because he's the earliest person, Nyingma, that we have that writes a book about Madhyamaka, sort of. And it's been translated into English, and it's called by Heidi Koppel, called Establishing Appearance as Divine. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just going to read you a little bit of it, and you can, and then I'll tell you what some people, different people, say about what this means. So this is the very beginning. It's not a very long text. This is the very beginning of it. It says, the Vajra vehicle of secret mantra says that all phenomena, without any distinction, are primordially enlightened as the mandala of Vajra body, speech, and mind. And this is not, this mandala is not something accomplished through a path. It's the fundamental nature. So it's a tantric equivalent of the Uttara Tantra Shastra kind of thing, I guess. Here one may object. But all those phenomena that appear within the field of experience of sentient beings are not what they seem to be. We have all these like false and delusory experiences, all these coarse dualistic conventionalities. These are of the nature of delusion, and you can't be saying that they are primordially enlightenment from the very beginning. And then Rongzomba says in response to this objection, yes, this is nothing but delusion. But this delusion of sentient beings, besides this delusion of sentient beings, there is nothing else which might be posited or shown. These phenomena, known as delusion, are all that there is. And you're thinking, well, that would be a bad place for the book to stop. Because it's sort of a surprising response, you know, I thought. But then the next paragraph, he goes on to sort of say, okay, well, this is what non-Buddhists say about, you know, that there's a permanent personal self. And this is what Vaibhashikas say about the characteristics of impermanence. And this is what Sautrantikas say about negating the personal self, and the Vaibhashikas say about that. And then there's the Yogacarans who believe that the dependent nature is empty of any imputation. And then there are the Madhyamakas who assert that all phenomena are ultimately free from the extremes of existence, non-existence, and so forth. And then, so do you see what I'm saying? There's a ladder of tenets going on, and it starts with Vaibhashika, and it goes to Madhyamaka, and then above it, there's the secret mantra. And this, according to the secret mantra, the two truths are inseparable and are primordial enlightenment. Thus, wandering beings set forth their individual views, and they argue about these views based on the character of their shared perception. But and there are, hence, no separate subjects that we could actually be investigating. In this way, all apparent phenomena are nothing but delusion, and there is, moreover, no freedom from delusion to be achieved by dispelling delusion. Delusion is, by its own essence, completely pure and hence enlightened. All phenomena are, in this way, primordially, fully, and completely enlightened. Phenomena appearing as various attributes are therefore, indeed, the mandala of the Vajra body, speech, and mind. They are the Buddhas of the three times, never going beyond their original essence of complete purity. So sentient beings and Buddhas are never differentiated in terms of their basic nature. Just like distinct causes and results appearing in a dream, they're nothing but the perceptions of individual minds brought forth by the power of imputation. And so forth. So anyway, you get that. And the rest, it's not a very long book, and that I think gives you the gist of the way that he argues. He has a sort of interesting way of expressing himself, right? And you wonder, like, well, what does he really think, that we shouldn't try to overcome, you know, like, overcome delusions so that our Buddha light can shine out? Or is it just, like, enough to recognize that it's, you know, impossible to get rid of these delusions, but we need to just recognize that in their nature, just as they are being deluded and painful, that they are fundamentally already pure, right? And he doesn't really get into that. It's not like an elaborate text like Dolpa. Dolpa has an answer to that for his system. He would say, oh yeah, everything is ultimately fundamentally pure, but you still have to practice the path to realize this conventional Buddha body that will let the ultimate one shine out. But Rangsamba doesn't say that. Okay. So anyway, Heidi Koppel, in, you know, translates this, studies this text, she says that basically the upshot of Rangsamba's argument is that Dzogchen trumps Madhyamaka as the highest view, and that Madhyamaka is the highest non-tantric view, but the highest view is that of Dzogchen because it has this profound understanding of non-duality. I guess it's about what? Dzogchen?
Yeah.
Does this only say that Dzogchen is higher than Madhyamaka?
Yeah.
He does. Where?
Oh, I thought you were repeating my question and answering it.
No, I don't think he said that. In fact, we just read yesterday that he says that. What he's going to say is that Dzogchen is an effective path because it will incorporate the same kind of understanding that goes along with Prasangika Madhyamaka. In fact, he does say that. We read it last year in the last essay in Kindness, Clarity, Insight. That's what he says. That's basically the thrust of that whole article. He doesn't say Dzogchen's okay even though they never get it, the emptiness that Tsongkhapa taught. He said it's okay precisely because when they do this searching to see how the mind arises, abides, and disappears, and what its characteristics are, they're doing effectively an ultimate analysis that realizes the emptiness of the mind, and therefore we can consider that it meets the criteria, you know, of being having a prasangika madhyamika view, even if it doesn't have that label. That's what he said. Okay, so then that's Rangsamba, and then there's a lot of other, of course, great, you know, Nyingma Lamas, but Longchenpa, or his full name is Longchen Rabchenpa, 1308 to 1363, is really important. I mean, there's different ways of telling the whole history of Nyingma. I mean, there's this sort of prehistory part, all the stuff before Padmasambhava, and then there's the Padmasambhava stuff, you know, and I was thinking about this today. It's like, oh, in those days, it wasn't like there was Nyingma. You know what I'm saying? It's like nobody said, oh, there's the old one. No, I mean, it was just Buddhism in Tibet, right? And then there wasn't really Nyingma until there was like other Buddhists there who said, hey, we're not like them. You know what I'm saying? And then it's like, oh, they're the Nyingma. You know, so Nyingma had to organize itself. It was all these different people doing all these different practice lineages. It wasn't like that they had some big monastic university or something like that. There'd been this situation during the dark period there where Buddhism was just hanging on by its fingernails. And so it had to be revived and also had to be organized and systematized. And so Longchenpa is like not just a famous Dzogchen poet and teacher, but he was also like a great systematizer and writer and organizer. So I think a lot of, you know, if we write, you know, a story about Nyingma, a lot of what we were writing wouldn't have been able to be written before Longchenpa. Longchenpa organizes it so that we can tell an organized story about what was going on. So in some sense, you know, it's like if I'm just looking at it from the outside, you almost can say, like in some sense, that Longchenpa is the person who starts Nyingma as we know it. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like some people say, oh, Jesus didn't start Christianity, Paul did, right? Or something like that, you know. And then it's like in that way, there's not really a Nyingma until you have somebody who takes all this stuff and says, oh, how does this work? How does it fit together? What makes a system out of it? And that's what Longchenpa did. And of course, he was also really famous as a Dzogchen teacher and writer. And now, when we read Longchenpa for the first time, then you come up against this difficulty when you're coming from the Gelugpa point of view, is that they have lots of different words. Lots of different special terms. We just mentioned a few, but there's lots of these words. And when you say, well, what does that one mean? Then they all turn out to sort of mean the same thing in some sense, because what else is there to be talking about? You see what I'm saying? Well, I'm just expressing my experience of this. It's like I have this grasping, conceptualizing, dualistic mind, and I want to figure out, well, what is the argument of this text, and what is the view that it's propounding, you know? And it's like, well, it's, you know, you're saying, what kinds of distinctions is the author trying to make? And that, of course, is trying to undo all of those presuppositions that I bring to the text. So it's like frustrating in that way. If you come at it as a mystic or something, then it's different from you come at it with this idea of saying, well, what's the argument here? There's no argument. This is a song. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, then we, that was the situation. And Nyingma didn't really, for a long time, have... Well, of course, there were hermits. It wasn't like everybody was necessarily getting married, but some people did. It wasn't like there was a big monastic tradition. Remember, the whole monastic ordination lineage died out during the dark period. So there's a lot of lay practice always in Nyingma. And then, although they're Nyingma monks, they didn't have like organized monastic centers, you know, for a long time until they started maybe in the 17th century, and then the 18th century they had a lot more. So then you have this great luminary who comes on the scene in the 19th century, Nipam. And it's really interesting, it's like that Nyingmas were doing their thing, and it didn't really require them to like write commentaries on or sub-commentaries on or explanations of Chandrakirti or Nagarjuna or, you know, Aryadeva or, you know, what are the great Nyingma commentaries on Arya? I mean, just like, they're not like, they don't have like monastic, Nyingma monastic universities where everybody's like studying the Indian Shastras and like putting forth the Dzogchen view of them. It wasn't like that. And so it's like at the other opposite end from Gelugpa in terms of being focused on the practice and experience side. And then Mipham came along and he put this together. Like Rongsongba, he said, okay, exactly how are we going to talk about the relationship between Madhyamaka and Dzogchen? So taking a Dzogchen point of view as a Nyingma, he seriously engages Tsongkhapa. It's clear that he's read Tsongkhapa. He not only read Tsongkhapa, he reads Shatarakshita. I mean, he reads all the Indian Shastras from a Dzogchen point of view. And then he decides to write, you know, a Nyingma commentary on an Indian Madhyamaka Shastra, which is by Shatarakshita. So that was written in the 19th century, and that's like, Nipam creates then the beginning of the possibility of having Nyingma textbooks on Madhyamaka philosophy or Nyingma textbooks on logic or and so forth, like so that now you can have a Nyingma monastic college where people go and study, you know, Buddhist philosophy within a Dzogchen is the big framework, but in the meantime, here's some stuff that, you know, we should be learning until you get to be a Buddha. And so down to today, now you still do have, you know, that kind of stuff that goes on, and it goes back to Nipam, you know, setting up that way of being able to do things. All right. So, let's see. Okay. So I have two Nipam texts, and one you also have, and I like it, and then another one you don't have, and in some ways it's even more amazing, but it has so many interesting points in it. So this one that you don't have is Nipam's Beacon of Certainty, which is called Illuminating the Great Perfection. So it's, you know, presented as like this is the Beacon of Certainty, his book on great perfection. But if you read it, it's not like Longchenpa. It's not a practice manual. It's not like here's how to go practice Dzogchen. It's not like that at all. It's basically a book about Madhyamaka written from here's 5 or 6 or 8 major problems in Madhyamaka. Here's how I, as a Nyingma Dzogchen person, will look at them. And it's not short. He analyzes them in detail, you know, from a Nyingma point of view. So let's start, though, by looking at the Sword of Wisdom that discerns meaning, if you guys have that. I'll read some of it and make some commentary then as I go on. I bow to Manjushri, the treasure of wisdom, who holds perfect philosophical tenets, utterly abandons all error, and has doubt-free knowledge of the three points. So I was like stopped right there. What's this? What are these three things? Well, he's going to say that like with a treasure of wisdom that Manjushri holds consists of these things, including philosophical tenets. And then what are the other, what utterly abandons all error turns out to be, you know, non-dualistic, pristine wisdom. That's not surprising. But has doubt-free knowledge of the three points. Well, you know, there's a commentary on this. So, you know, I read the commentary. It's like the doubt-free knowledge of the three points. That means inferential knowledge, like using logic with a syllogism. The three points are basically the three. So, okay, and that's the first verse. He's just doing praise to Manjushri, and he's already got inferential logic in as one of the main things, the treasures that Manjushri holds. Okay, I will shine the light of intelligence on those who wish to taste the nectar of the Sukhita's teachings on what is hard to understand, the profound and the best. Teachings of the Buddha's Dharma will properly rely on the two truths, truth of worldly convention and the truth that is the sublime meaning. Regarding the natures of these two truths, if you would know them without error, the good eyes of the two flawless types of reliable cognition prove to be the very best. He starts right in talking about Sema, or in Tibetan, or Pramana, that there's such thing as reliable knowledge, and one of these two types of reliable knowledge gets at conventional phenomena, and the other one gets at ultimate phenomena. Right? And so then he talks for a while about what he has to say about conventional, and then he goes to the ultimate. But just what he says about conventional is really interesting. These appearances around us. Okay, let me just note that he calls them these appearances. He doesn't say these existence. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? This is like this is just the way that in many tantric texts, but also in, you know, Gaudiya texts and Nyingma texts, it's like, well, let's not call them existence and like give away the game to start with. What's the phenomenological situation here is like, well, things are appearing to us. So let's just call it what it is and not, you know, get into the question of how real they are just in the process of giving them the name. So these appearances around us are generated through the process of dependent arising. Just as a lotus in the sky never appears, so we will never see anything independent. The completion of a collection of causes carries out the function of bringing about an effect. I'm like, where's the Dzogchen in this? You know, like, where's the spontaneous popping out of base nine? It's like, okay. It sounds like the completion of a collection of causes carries out the function of bringing about an effect. The entire identity of each diverse effect depends upon its particular causes. Therefore, by knowing what is and is not the case for causes and effects, we can avoid one thing and pursue another. Crafts and such, as well as philosophical tenets, all have this as their starting point. Right? It's like if you want to make a table, or, you know, catch a bird, or, you know, whatever you're doing, you have to be able to distinguish this from that. And that's exactly the same point I was making at lunch. It's the same thing. So he's saying we can avoid one thing and pursue another, because we can make these distinctions between how cause-dependent arising works. This includes any practice that might be done in this world and beyond. Each and every phenomenon is produced through dependent arising, is something unique, and bears the features of a distinctive status. Conventional realities such as hard, wet, and warm are undeniable. In fact, even in the case of a single phenomenon, there's no limit to all the conventional statements about the various qualities that it might have or lack. Direct perception fully apprehends the state of each thing's respective identity. So, you know, like, I'm thinking, this sounds like Tsongkhapa would agree with, like, everything he's saying, like, so far. And then he goes up, direct perception fully, and then conceptual minds. So he does direct perception. Conceptual minds then distinguish and apply qualities such as being different, or, you know, whatever abstract idea you have about the thing, that they impute to those things via mental exclusion. Well, you know, we don't have to get into that, but this whole mental exclusion is a reference to the whole process of the way conceptuality is understood to work in Dharmakirti, you know, coming down to Tsongkhapa, right? So it's like, he's not just saying, oh, conceptuality, gross, dualistic, you know, like, and it's like, no, it's like, he's understanding that we have to have these thoughts, and he knows exactly how they work in exactly the same way that, like, earlier Buddhist philosophers said. Objects of knowledge understood by means of two distinct aspects, the actual substance of things, he means like what perception gets at, and what is imputed via exclusion. That's the conceptual knowledge of it. So there's conceptual objects of knowledge and perceived objects of knowledge. There's lots of different presentations of this. Okay, so then he goes to the ultimate. Right here, there's no transition. When the nature of things as cause and effect is analyzed well in terms of reality, no producer is seen, and there are no dependently produced dependent arising. Each thing appears to have its own nature, but is empty of its own essence. And this is the sphere of reality, possessed of three liberations. This is the ultimate reality. Okay, so now he's set up what something that he's to say about the two truths that sounds just like so far what Tsongkhapa would say about Madhyamaka. Men, since functioning and being dependent, it took me a while to figure out that functioning means the conventional aspect, and being dependent is a reference to the fact that things have no existence in and of themselves. So functioning and being dependent, that's like what's sort of like the conventional and the ultimate. These are what are real about each thing, and the limits of knowledge cannot be traced beyond reasoning that's based in these realities. So then it goes into the different types of perception. And there's four types of direct perception. Non-mistaken sense and mental perception, along with self-cognition and yogic perception. It's wrong to say that perception does not exist. And this is really interesting. Why is it wrong to say that perception exists? Why would it be wrong to deny direct perception? I was thinking, well, because the direct evidence of our experience seems to contradict it. No, that's not what he says. It's wrong because if you denied it, then there would be no evidence to use an inference. Isn't that interesting? That's like Tsongkhapa's argument. That, you know, when we have to reason to understand reality, and we can't do reasoning unless we can rely upon some information that we've gotten from our ordinary conventional perception. Well, he doesn't say that. He's not quoting Tsongkhapa, but that's the way he's saying. We have to have perception because otherwise we wouldn't be able to reason. It would be impossible to take stock of appearances and how they arise from causes and then cease. If that were the case, on what basis would we be able to realize them as empty? And then he, you know, quotes Chandrakirti, you know, ultimate is not realized without relying on the conventional. So, you know, he's saying that's what he's taking Chandrakirti to mean when he said the ultimate doesn't arise except relying on the conventional, is that you need to have some information from your ordinary conventional perceptions in order to use inference to realize the ultimate reality. When the mental faculty generates a clear dark demarcation between an internal or external object, this is what we call mental perception. If we didn't have this, we would have none of our cognitions that constitute our ordinary awareness of things. Then he says, like, why we need meditation-based yogic perception to know what's beyond ordinary world. And then this is the next verse here, just as the experience of direct perception is about this Romric, you know, self-perception. Just as the experience of direct perception cuts off conceptual superimpositions about form and so forth. You know, it's like knowing directly what a form is with your senses is a way to cut through your false ideas or distortions or generalizations that are characteristic of your conceptual representation of it. In just the same way, direct perception does the same thing with the mind itself. So you, in other words, you have to, the mind has to be able to know itself. In other words, otherwise there would have to be some other mind to know that mind and establish it. So the way that he says you avoid an infinite regress is you just put this faculty of self-awareness into each moment of consciousness. That's not what Tsongkhapa believes. Tsongkhapa thinks that implies that the thing will be self-existent, but lots of other people disagree with Tsongkhapa, not just Mipham. Also, you have to remember, Mipham's Madhyamaka is going to turn out to be a Yogacara Madhyamaka, which who did he pick out of all the Madhyamakas to write a commentary on? You know, Shantarakshita. So he's like coming from a point of view of a Madhyamaka system that takes it for granted that you need to have this kind of thing. So then it goes on about like self-cognition for a while. So let's go to the next page. Conceptual minds know their objects by apprehending a general meaning mixed together with the name. These minds proliferate the world's conventions, just like we talked about this yesterday. Even those beings who know no language accept and reject meanings with conceptual minds to which there appear general images that are fit to be mixed with names. It's like, you know, yeah, like even animals have sort of conceptual representations which they could apply a name to. Were there no conceptual minds, then there would be no conventions of refutation of proof. And in that case, there would be possible to have any inference as the basis for practice. Conceptual thought comprehends and establishes all that is not evident to the senses, such as the fact that the future is coming. And if we had no inferential thought, we would all be like newborn children. So when the sign on the basis of which something can be understood fulfills the three modes, the present is subject, forward pervasion, the reverse pervasion, that's the three points that he talked about in the first verse, then that proof has no flaw. So he accepts logic. He not only accepts inference, but he demands it and requires it in order to be indispensable for the process of liberation. Page 5. What is empty? Let's see. Am I missing a verse? Oh yeah. In terms of their basic way of existing, emptiness and what is empty are not different at all. Now we're getting a little Dzogchen interlude. So the indivisibility of appearance and emptiness is inexpressible, and we each must realize it for ourselves. Various sorts of proof and demonstration involving what exists and what something is, and negating what does not exist and what something is not. When you yourself have understood all this logic and you're sure about how to set things up with demonstrations and negations based on reliable knowledge from inference, then you can teach other people proofs and refutations that are consistent with reasoning. And then he goes on in the next section to distinguish between pure conventional knowledge and impure conventional knowledge, and how you should use the impure to enter into the pure. And when you do,
as though clearing the eye of any fault at the bottom of this page. Cleanse the eyes of reliable knowledge and behold the final purity and the final equality. So, you know, that's, we're going to use reasoning to understand. It's very much like, you know, we're going to use reasoning to understand that things are empty, and then we're going to go beyond that into this inexpressible primordial non-dual union of emptiness and appearance. We set forth a presentation of minds that are reliable and those that are not, inasmuch as conceptual and non-conceptual consciousness might be mistaken or non-mistaken, as in the case of seeing two moons, dreaming, or seeing a snake. If there weren't any distinction between reliable minds and unreliable minds, then there wouldn't be any difference at all between what is mistaken and true, and what is false and what is not. So it's like, there wouldn't be any tenets. When we analyze in terms of reality, all these presentations, every sort of presentation of reliable perception, inference, unreliable minds, they're all proven empty of essential nature. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to make them and tell you that they're important anyway, even though, do you see what I'm saying? It's just, there's all these things and they're utterly empty, but they're also indispensable. Therefore, utter freedom from all elaborations abides, just as heat abides in fire, within every conventional elaboration. It's interesting. We have all these conventional elaborations, but just as heat abides in fire, their utter freedom from all elaborations is right there within them. So, you know, I thought this was interesting because it's sort of like, well, this is why he feels so comfortable being like the master of all these elaborations, because as a Dzogchen master, he understands all these elaborations as non-dual, from unelaborated reality. It's not like he's going away from unelaborated reality by engaging in all these elaborations. They're never separate. You can't be separate from it. Right? Thus, since appearance and emptiness arise inseparably in everyone, when one considers them as method and result, it's impossible to say which is which. But that was interesting. But does the perspective of the world alone, without analyzing what is reliable knowledge and what is not, engage the ultimate? Indeed, that this is a question. Like, can you have a worldly mind that knows ultimate reality? Right? We talked about that before. I was thinking he would say, no way. He says, oh, indeed, that is not precluded. Because seeing this arising from that is the dependent arising. Seeing that this arises from that is the world's perception. And inferences about the ultimate are drawn on this basis. I think he just said that you can have inferential realization of ultimate reality. It's like he's giving the Gelupas a lot more than other people are. Don't you think? Okay, let's skip over to page 7. The conventional, what we know, is not real. Neither knowledge of the conventional nor enlightened self-awareness are real when analyzed. The single truth that is the final indivisibility of the two truths is nirvana. Pettit's translation of the Beacon of Certainty uses coalescence of this. I don't know, I hadn't gotten into coalescence. This is the limit of reality, because everything finally comes back to this final indivisibility or coalescence of appearance and emptiness. This non-duality of knower and known is embodied in the radiance of sublime wisdom without limit or center. So opening the sharp eyes of wisdom, knowing the profound and the vast in this way, behold the good path from which have come the Sugatas and their wisest children. This is a fortunate discovery of something rare, and the method of both sutra and tantra. Do not let it all be for nothing. Those who are illuminated with an intelligence possessed of the four-point reasoning do not count on others, but use analysis to develop certainty in the four reliances. Okay, you know what the four reliances are. Right, relying on the meaning, not the words, relying on the teacher, not the teaching, not the teaching, not the teacher, rely on the definitive, not the provisional, rely upon sublime wisdom, not like ordinary mind. But what is this four-point reasoning? Well, this is like something that's like actually not actually unique to Nyingma, but
It's not discussed very much in other schools, and Rongsongba actually uses this. So they have this idea about four kinds of reasoning. And I don't want to go through it, but I just want to point out that, like, I'm going to talk about it again a little bit tomorrow, but it's just this concept. It's like a Nyingma reasoning concept that Rongsongba uses, and then Nipam uses, that comes in here. So if you don't have the four reliances, like a blind person depending on a blind guide, you'll turn them inside out by working from popular opinion, mere words, and shallow thinking. To rely on the Dharma rather than on persons means that a liberation comes from the teaching of a path on which reason establishes what is real, rather than from the person who's doing the teaching. Isn't that interesting? It's like, where's the Lama? So then he says, any proper teaching, this is what he's talking about, the Lama, any proper teaching will work, no matter how the teacher seems. Even the Sukhutas, in order to train their followers, might appear as butchers and the like. If someone who seems to be a teacher gives teachings that contradict the meaning of the Mahayana, then like a demon in the guise of a Buddha, nothing good will come of it. Even as you study and reflect on the Dharma, do not rely on the words, but rather rely on the meaning. If you understand the meaning, you'll find no contradiction, no matter what the verbal style. When someone trying to express a point is trying to express a point so that it may be, when someone trying to express a point so that it may be understood uses a word, and you do in fact understand the meaning, to then at that point persist in verbal elaborations is like finding an ox that you had set out to find and then continuing to search. I wonder who he's talking about now. If you fixate on words and elaborate on them, discursive thinking will just keep increasing forever. You will neglect the meaning more and more. And this is how children exhaust themselves. Tree is just one word. But when we divide up trees as to their habitat, etc., there's no end. Still, if just that word, one word, we understand what is meant, then the purpose of the term is fulfilled. It's like, in other words, we're never going to find the word that exactly expresses reality as it is. It's inexpressibly complicated, variegated, and you know, there's no end to the things that you could say about it, and you'll never come exactly to it the way it is. And so that's not what words are for. You know, they're not going to work like that. And then he uses the finger. When a finger points to the moon, children just look at the finger. So it is that fools cling to mere words, thinking that they know the meaning, but they struggle to get to the point. So I'm going to skip some of the next part, and on the middle of the next page, he says, minds that have the character of apprehender and apprehended are identified by their possession of an observed object. And no matter how they observe any object of observation, they are false. Now he's changed his way of talking about things a little bit, and it's like all dualistic minds, which included all the ones like he was talking about before, is saying it's like when they're grasping, they have a quality of falseness. They cannot directly touch the meaning of reality itself. Why? Because the meaning of reality is the thing that he takes as reality itself is primordial non-dual union of appearance and emptiness. So it's not like something that it's like the very nature of consciousness that has an aspect of subject and object is contrary to the whole nature of reality itself, which is this non-dual union. You might observe it as, you can look at reality as a thing or a non-thing or both or neither, but no matter how they observe their object of apprehension, as the sutra says, any apprehension of an object, any grasping at an object of observation is the domain of Mara. This is very interesting because this domain of Mara is what he was just telling us before was like essential and indispensable for our practice of the path. Like, how are we going to have inference if we don't have an apprehension and an object of apprehension, you know? So we've gone into sort of, he's switched over from like the Madhyamaka Dharmakirti and Chandrakirti mode, and he's gone over into like the Dzogchen mode. And so from this point of view, it's like well, all of these things have to be recognized as in some way, from an ultimate point of view, ultimately having this quality of deceptiveness. It's not like there was something, okay, everything I said before is wrong, now I'm going to tell you the real thing. He just goes on and like starts talking about like this.
So don't take it as, neither taking it as a positive thing or a negative thing can overcome the fact that it's an object of observation that you're setting up dualistically and grasping to. You'll be free when you see without rejecting or affirming. So you could say that this is like a path thing, like we were talking about. It's saying, look, you have to have all these dualistic conceptions in order to understand the meaning of reality, but then you really don't get it until you can see without accepting or rejecting anything. Stripped of all apprehenders and objects of apprehension, the self-arisen sublime wisdom is a clear light unto itself. Just as someone born blind has never seen the sun, children, that's us, have never seen this reality. No matter how they think about it, they can't understand it, and so it terrifies them. Still, through the power of scriptures on reality and reasoning that refutes all extremes, both, and personal instruction from a spiritual teacher, this light will come to you like sight to the blind. And at that point, with the confidence of having savored the flavor of the Tathagata's Dharma elixir, your vast and joyful vision will gaze upon the Sugata's sublime wisdom body. It's like to see the actual nature of the actual real nature. Here, you reach the final understanding of all things without exception as equal. And while you thereby gain definite assurance that they're inexpressible, it's still skillful to express the inexhaustible Dharma treasure. You see what he did? He like went into this Dzogchen world and then he came back and said, yeah, all these things are like just amazing and inexpressible. But and you know you're going to have to talk about it and to be able to help people. Right? And then that takes you back around to where we were before. Like when you start talking about it, how are you going to talk about it in a way that makes sense? Well, we've got all these distinctions that really make that work. If you gain skill in how the two truths work, you come to see the meaning of their inextricable union. At that point, as though stripping the husk to get at the kernel, you see that all Buddhist methods are aiming at this point. Therefore, with the thought, the Sukhata knows methods, and these methods themselves are the path to reality, you develop an irreversible faith in the teacher and his teaching. By attaining the highest sublime wisdom of non-abiding, you are naturally liberated from the extremes of cyclic existence and peace, and the flow of your great compassion spreads without strain, pervading the farthest reaches of space and time. Okay, so that's as much as I don't know how much I gave you, but that's as much as I want to read. So, now, I'll see. We still have more time. I went through it kind of fast, but I think that text is really easy to follow. And it's also, I find it really kind of beautifully written and fun in some of the ways, you know, the way he expresses himself. And at the same time, you know, it's like, this is not like other, this is, you're not reading Longchenpa anymore. You know what I'm saying? This is like, he's taken this Dzogchen perspective. And he said, oh yeah, all these things that arise in the mind are, you know, manifestations of this fundamental, indivisible union of appearance and emptiness. And that doesn't mean that that's all that we can, that's useful to say. How are we going to get from here to realizing that indivisible union? Well, other things that we say, is what he's saying to the point, it's like, within all these elaborations, there's this unelaborated nature. You don't have, just because we're using elaborations doesn't mean that we've betrayed. It's not only that we have betrayed, it's skillful to do so, right? Now let's figure out the most skillful way to elaborate so as to help people get to the inexpressible, primordial, non-dual union of appearance and emptiness, right? And it's like, I don't know, it just reminds me of this Chinese parallel of, you know, we talked yesterday about, you know, the first inexpressibility and the fact that, the Tao Te Ching starts with the first line, it's the Tao that can be named, or the path that can be followed is not the true path, or the Tao that can be spoken of as Tao, or the Tao that can be named Tao, it's not the true Tao. It's a lot of translations. But so the Tao that you can talk, let's just say the Tao that we can talk about as Tao is not the true Tao. So it's like, well, so there's, and then someone later said,
well, then the real Taoist must be these Confucian philosophers, because instead of trying to talk about that which is clearly inexpressible, they're going to write about how we can cultivate a better moral character, which is expressible.
The
one you were reading
from are different. Did you do both of them? Did you? Yeah. They weren't on the same page. They're farther down on our text.
Are they different actual words?
Yeah. Very different translations.
Like you have one most to accept or reject, and you said what to avoid or pursue.
Yeah, they're both me. I guess it's different drafts. So they're both my translations. Yeah. Sorry. I didn't know that I did that. So. I wanted to get through a couple other points here. It's like the other text, that's like a lot of text to get through, and the other text is like even longer and more complicated. So I thought maybe since we do have a little bit of time, maybe I should like pick some points out of it, here and there. This is from the Beacon of Certainty, and as I said, this is like supposed to be a text that, unlike this one, which is on wisdom in general as a topic, this text is supposed to be specifically about Dzogchen, but in fact, it's like takes all these different Madhyamaka issues, and some of the issues he takes are, for example, is emptiness a absolute negation or a non-affirming negative, or is emptiness an affirming negative? That's the first one he takes. One of his other questions is, which of the two truths is more important? And does Madhyamaka have a position or not? So he talks about some of these things. So on the first topic, he says a lot of things, frankly. It's a little, it's like kind of like this, and then it goes around. He says, you don't have it, but it's Mipham's Beacon of Certainty by John Whitney Pettit. And he says that the Gelupas say that the view is an absolute negation, and other people say that it's an implicative negation. It's like an affirming negative, a negation that implies something else in its place. And he says, well, both of these things are intellectually designated, and in the ultimate sense, neither is accepted. This is the original reality beyond intellect, which is free from both negation and proof. And but he doesn't stop there. Then he says, but if you ask about the way in which emptiness is just established, just, in other words, just how do people, not like how it is in the ultimate sense, right, but how people establish it, then it's just an absolute negation. So he's talking about emptiness now. He's not and by the way, it's clear, he doesn't think emptiness is the final reality. What's the final reality? I did tell you. Right. You have to, it's this coalescence or primordial, indivisible union of appearance and emptiness, or union of the two truths. So that's the dharmata, or the real nature. But emptiness is the negative side. So then, interestingly, in the next verse he says, in India, the glorious Chandrakirti, and in Tibet, Rongsongpa Churgi's Sangbo, both said this with one voice, the intention and expressed the great emptiness of primordial purity. Which is really interesting because, and this is all through Mipham. Mipham, says, everything I am saying comes from Longchenpa, and he says, this is all my stuff on Madhyamaka comes from Rongsongpa, And so he links himself to the earlier people in the tradition. He doesn't say, and I cribbed this out of Tsongkhapa, right? And it's like, but this Rongsongpa, when you read it, it doesn't seem to be saying you know, Dzogchen and Madhyamaka are the same thing. It seems to be saying that Dzogchen is higher than Madhyamaka. But Mipham interprets it that Chandrakirti and Ramsambha were always like, had the same intention. Okay. So, let's see. Dharmas are primordially pure. They are originally without any intrinsic reality. So they are not born in either of the two truths. So why fret about the expression non-existent? In the place of a pillar, primordially pure, then there is nothing non-empty whatsoever. There's nothing non-empty means nothing, you know, truly existence, no true existence there. So if you don't then negate it by saying there is no pillar, then what are you doing? What does it mean to say that the pillar does not exist? The emptiness that is the negation of the pillar and a leftover appearance are not fit to coalesce. So, this is what I understand him to be saying, is that when he says it's an absolute negation or a sheer emptiness is a non-affirming negative, what he understands that to mean is not being expressed in the same way Tsongkhapa would say. He's saying when you do, and this is an interesting question. Okay, so when I ask the question, when I do ultimate analysis on the table, I say, is this table, you know, can I find this table as like one with its parts or different from its parts? Is it a collection of the parts? And like, where is the table? Okay. And so now we know that Tsongkhapa will say that that doesn't refute the table. The table's not being refuted. But here's the other question. What am I looking for? What am I searching for? Am I searching for the table, or am I searching for the inherent existence of the table? And this turns out to be a question that's a little bit subtler. If you say, look, I'm looking for an inherently existent table, and I can't find it anywhere among the parts of the table, then somebody could say, well, you know, so you've proved that an inherently existent table is not inherently existent, but what about the table?
Right.
On the other hand, if I say there's no table in the table, then, well, what is there? It seems like that might be like table doesn't exist since there's no table to the table at all. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, so people's like, well, which is it? And I think R.E.D., somebody has a passage that says, this analysis of ours, that is an analysis when you're, you know, doing the different reasonings, is intent upon finding the nature. That means that's understood as meaning. When we analyze in this way, we're looking for some essential nature. Okay, so that can be, Tsongkhapa interprets that to mean that, you know, when you're doing this analysis, you're not like disproving the existence of the pot, you know. You're disproving the existence of a nature in pot such as would be findable under that kind of analysis if it existed, right? It's like you say, if you're really good at looking for pots and you look over in the east for a pot and then there's no pot there, then that would disprove the existence of the pot. But it doesn't in the east, but it doesn't say anything about in the west and so forth like that. So this is just like if there were a nature that was intrinsically existent, then we would find it when we ask that question. But it's not refuting the mere existence of the pot. But then still you have the question, it's like, well, when I ask that question though, and I asked the question, you know, is like, for example, I was explaining this one time at another Dharma center, actually, and I said, well, I'm looking for the table. Is this the table? I looked for the table in all the different parts of the table. And one other, you know, former Dharma person who is from the university was saying, well, that's not what Tsongkhapa says. You're looking for the wrong thing. You don't want to prove that there's no table there at all. You want to prove that there's no inherently existent table. And I said, well, no. I think that if I look for the table really hard and I don't find it, that will prove that there's no inherently existent table. But if I set out to look for an inherently existent table, then, well, I wasn't even, you know, that's quite a different matter. The unfindability under analysis of an inherently existing table will mean to me that there's no inherently existent inherently existing table, but it won't tell me about the table. Do you see what I'm saying? So then, but then it's still more problems. This isn't like, you know, people say different things about this within Galuppa, because then it's like, okay, what's all this business about identifying the object of negation then? Like when we actually meditate on emptiness, they say, just don't set out and look for the table. You should first identify your conception of the table as inherently existent and then realize that that's what's being refuted. Well, if that's what's being refuted, is that the same saying as that's the thing that I'm looking for when I start up to do the analysis? You see what I'm saying? So, okay, now I've just sort of put that problem out there so that you can but think about what you want about it. But I say that relates to what he's doing here. Because he's saying, well, you know, you want to, like, when we say, when we look for, if a pillar appears, when we do our analysis, we should say, from the point of view of that analysis, there's no pillar. Having done the analysis, we can make a statement from the point of view of that analysis, there is no pillar. And if you don't, then you're doing the horn thing. You're saying, oh, you know, it's like you've added something extra on and then you've subtracted it again by analysis. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, this is what, you know, gets the Gilupas in, is being like logic choppers rather than yogis, because they're accused then of, you know, not actually like refuting their actual conceptions of things as existing vividly as set up right there as they appear, and instead it's just like adding something extra on and then proving that it's inconsistent and then leaving the vivid appearance of things that's just unscathed, right? And this criticism of Gelugpa for having this horn-like or hat-like add-on called inherent existence, which is the only thing we're willing to refute, even though other people haven't heard of it. And no one goes around thinking about it, right? But we're willing to refute it, right? And this criticism comes from other Gelugpas. I mean, it comes from within Gelugpas. They say, like, hey, you know, we're not really getting at it if we just, you know, keep thinking like that. And so it's not the normal. This is like for us, you know, they're becoming nihilists. But outside of Gelugpa, that's like the normal way to talk about Madhyamaka. Okay, not the abnormal. So then he has this really pithy thing. To say that a pillar is not empty of a pillar, to say that a pillar is not empty of being a pillar, that would be Tsongkhapa's position. Pillar is not empty of being a pillar. Pillar is empty of being inherently existent as a pillar. It's not empty of pillar. Right? Who want, you know, it's like, that's obviously nihilistic. I'm being Tsongkhapa now. What?
Huh? What do you get right into?
Yeah, exactly. So a pillar is not empty of being a pillar. And that would be the Tsongkhapa position. Or to say that the real nature is empty of being a pillar. Who would say that? Who would say the real nature is not empty of itself, but it's empty of being a pillar? That's Dolpapa. So he says, those people who say that the pillar is not empty of a pillar, and the other people who say that the real nature is empty of being a pillar, both of those people, is to posit a basis of emptiness and something of which is empty. These are verbal and ontological extrinsic emptinesses. Whoa! He puts W-O-E exclamation point. If this thing is not empty of itself, if things are not empty of themselves, then the empty basis is not empty. And it's going to be left over after you're done the refuting. You see what I'm saying? You're saying, like in case of Dolpapa, You haven't refuted the intrinsic existence of the Dharmata. And just, he's saying, basically saying, and Tsongkhapa is just as bad. Because, I mean, in a way, it's worse. He hasn't even refuted the intrinsic, the actual, you know, existence as it's appeared to us of the conventional phenomena that are here. Why? Because he's like, he won't say that when you search for a pot, there's no pot. He just wants to say, when you search for a pot, there's no intrinsically existent pot. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What page page are you on?
This is page 196. It's just like the first page of the actual translation. Yeah. It's a lot of it. So, but isn't it interesting? I find it really interesting. I think that, you know, Mipham to me is like the great discovery. That's why I'm like taxing you with it so much. It's like I didn't have good karmic connection with my previous forays into Nyingma. And then I just find that he's a beautiful writer. And he's very subtle and creative in the way he uses language. And then this mixture of, you know, he's like totally aware of everything and very quick, you know, in the way he, this like little thing he doesn't even, of just like putting Tsongkhapa together with Dolpapa in like one verse just like that. How did he do that? How did he come up with that? Great. So, and that was one thing I wanted to make a point about. He goes on about that point quite a lot, and he blends it into a lot of talk about coalescence and so forth. If you're refuting something other than the thing as being findable in the thing, then he makes fun of that. He says, it's like, well, everybody knows a cow is not a horse. He said, you know, if you're realizing something other than the pillar as not being there, findable in the pillar, then why would Mahamata have said to realize this is amazing? One of the perfectionists is like, well, that's not amazing. Anybody can see that a cow is not in a horse. You know, it's like, and that that reminded me of this thing that Jangya does, you know, where he uses the thing about the snake, and he says, it's like, well, you know, everybody knows that when, you know, in a twilight area there's a rope and somebody like sees it, as falsely imputes a snake to it, that no matter how you search, you know, you don't find any snake at all on the side of the rope. But it's the same with a snake. There's no snake at all on the side of the snake, right? And it's like, well, that you can find. Right? When you search, it's like, where is the snake? The snake arises in from our point of view in relationship to something that's being observed. But it's like, this is what you were alluding to the other day in the question thing. It's like, you can't say what it is except taking into account the point of view of a being who's observing it with certain kind of karma, certain kind of mind. Could be an enlightened being, but a certain kind of mind observing it. Unless you take into account the point of view, you can't talk about what it is. There are external objects, but we don't know what they are except in relationship to a mind that perceives them as something. That's the view. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that. It just reminded me of that because that's like a. Jangya doesn't, you know, say. Literally, there's no snake in the snake. But what he's doing is getting at exactly the same point in different words that Nipham is trying to get at. Is that you have to realize that, you know, when we talk about inherent existence to ward off our fear of falling to the extreme of nihilism, but it's really not a safe adventure. It's going into this reasoning is cutting away the whole foundation of how we perceive the world as existing. And when you talk about this thing, it's like, well, there's nothing there on the object side apart from how it appears to a mind, even though there are external objects. You start to realize, like, well, this is really not how we see the world. It's really kind of, it's hard to even think about, right? What that can mean, like you were saying the other day. What that would be like. I just can't get over this thing. It's like, okay, they're external objects, but I can't say what they are. This is what I was saying to you last year when we were talking about whether things were made out of atoms. Remember that? Mm-hmm. As like, well, things, you can't really say that things are established on the basis of atoms, you know, because they're established in relationship. Now, there are atoms. We can say that there are atoms, but is stuff really made out of atoms? I don't know. I think stuff, you know, stuff is made by mind is created by mind in relationship to external objects, which we understand as including atoms. But it's like, do you understand what I'm saying? It's not. We think of stuff as made out of atoms, but
the point should be that things contain atoms.
It doesn't mean they're made of them.
Yeah, it's that idea. Exactly. This idea of made out of is where the problem comes in. When you say things gain their existence or established or made out of, then he's like, well, there are atoms. Things we can say that from our point of view, it's correct to say things, you know, material objects have atoms. But if you say things exist because they're made out of atoms, then you've missed the boat. Yeah. They're imputed. They're ascribed, you know, from a point of view in relationship to a basis of designation, which for us, you know, from our point of view, includes atoms. But again, that's just from our point of view, right?
Is that how we have the union of appearance and emptiness?
Well, I think that's probably right. I haven't penetrated it to understand that exactly, but yeah.
When you said that, it sounded very enigmatic to me. When you said they're not made out of atoms, they're made out of mind.
Yeah, but the guy who told me to this was like a Losaling Geshe.
Exactly.
You know, he said,
I didn't
say they're made out of mind.
No,
I didn't say that. They're imputed by mind. They're ascribed or designated by mind. It becomes possible for us to talk about them as existing conventionally, you know, through the process of their minds ascribing or identifying or designating them, right? And not because there's something that, from their own side, is built up out of the right kind of atoms so that they objectively have a certain character.
Yeah. I guess what I felt like when you talked about that, it felt like emerge from mind, which is...
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't trying to do that.
Yeah, no, but...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I see.
Hearing it from that perspective.
Yeah, because we're doing all Enigma up until that moment. Yeah. Yeah. I just can't help myself from going back into Tsongkhapa. But I think that's okay, because, you know, like we were talking about at the beginning, it's like this is a dialogue. We're doing a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And we have to have our turn to talk. We had Nipham had. Okay. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Is that a basic Manyoka question?
Which?
I don't quite...
Oh, you do. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I don't understand how is there a valid basis of designation to impute something when anything that comprises the basis of designation also is just imputed itself?
Right. You feel like, well, there'd be an endless regress of minds that have to do this designating. Right. Well... You don't have to like go back before. It's like what appears to us in a certain way on the basis of our karma appears in the world in a certain way. Then we designate and impute in a certain way, and then if we make a mistake, then that's like corrected by, you know, further investigation and analysis. So you can't really go back and say like, well, like one thing I thought about is like, well, there would have to be some mind that previously designated the basis of designation as a suitable basis of designation before my mind could later designate it as that on the basis. Do you know what I'm saying? If nothing had already designated the basis.
Creator, designator. Yeah. Right. The creator.
Yeah, the designator, creator. Right. So it's like, if there's nothing that's already designated this as the suitable body parts. If there's nothing that's already designated this as the suitable body parts on the basis of which to have the person designated, then how can that designation take place? And then you have the problem of infinite regress, right? Right. But I don't think that that's what it actually means to something being merely designated on the basis of the object of imputation, that there's like has to be some like infinite regress of minds. I think it's about this: the things being merely existed in conventional terms means it goes back to this idea that we were just talking about, that there's nothing there on the object side that makes it what it is in and of itself. So what is it that constitutes it as X? Is that it's something? It is that we
we call it X, and that it becomes it's it if it works as in that way as X, or if it doesn't, then that, you know, if I call the lantern a cat, then that can be corrected by or falsified. I would say I've been thinking of, you know, saying falsified, and then sort of using this idea that like we have this provisional understandings of what things are that arise to us on the basis of our given, karmically given, you know, bodies and minds. But then these are susceptible to falsification or correction or revision, you know, based on further experience. And that's all there is. It's not like that there's some, that's what Chandrakirti says, is like what it means to have like a, you know, he doesn't say in the text a conventional valid knower, but that's what Tsongkhapa understands it to mean, right? Is conventional valid knowledge means like that, you know, an ordinary mind knowing something in a way that, like, with senses that are not impaired, such that it represents, you know, a an appropriate point of view for that kind of being, right?
So can it be like just culturally dependent?
That's a good question. I don't, you know, it's like that is never. I noticed that the Venerable Thupten Jhoden used the example of an ant yesterday when she's talking about whether this was a cup, you know, and it's like from our point of view, it's a cup, and no one will find out on closer investigation, you know, that it's actually some, you know, a turkey, but from an ant's point of view, it's like that's. It's not, there's no, it's not a cup, it's some, you know, as she was saying, some other kind of thing. So, but what about, like, cross-culturally? You know, you think, like, we're all humans, we have, would all have different, same kind of karma. But then people do really have, like, dramatically different, like, say, culturally situated, appropriate perceptions of things. And then you get in the question, is like, well, does this like open up complete cultural relativism? Which I don't think it does, because I think what it is that like, for practical purposes, a lot of times we have to consider that culture gives us a different way of understanding situations. But, and this is my interpretation, is like, it's not that we have a human essence, but that we're all human, we are all born as human beings, and we have the same. The faculties and karma to be born as human beings. So if it's sort of culturally appropriate in some culture to say, you know, subjugate women, it doesn't mean that we can't use evidence that's available to both us and them from the fact, you know, from a common understanding of what it means to be a human at the conventional level, to argue that they should change their practices. Do you see what I'm saying? We don't have to just accept, well, there in India or whatever, do you know what I'm saying, and so forth, that's the right way for them. I don't think it follows. It's different between cultures than it is between beings. We have, there's a big difference between going from one culture to another and going from one species to another. I really think so. I don't see it as the same. In any case, the problem with the discussion, I mean, that's my point of view. One problem with the whole question is that it's not discussed in any of the traditional texts. When they talk about this, they always use examples of different, not species, but realms. Yeah. Of course, we talked about this a lot last year, but I think this is one of the most, you know, profound ways to sort of open up our the weirdness that is the unlike the way we normally take for granted things are-ness of the Madhyamaka view, and just not be so blasé about it. And that is to, you know, think about, well, that, you know, there's spiders or something. It seems very clean, but maybe there's some like small bugs, right? I think there was about flies, yeah. And that they're it's not like, oh, they have that funky fly karma and makes them see things wrong. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like they have their legitimate perspective in the same place and time that they're like, it's sort of like, I was going to say it's a completely different world, but it's sort of not a completely different world, but it's like, it is a completely different world at the same time. And how can that be? How can there be like, completely different objects that are appearing, and it's because there aren't any objects that are objectively established there. Depends on the kind of mind that's present observing them, what kinds of objects are properly perceived. That's all there is. And so, I'll tell you, I appreciate your question. It's like, I spent a lot of time, and I've seen other people asking this question, trying to figure out, okay, if everything's designated by mind, when does this designation take place? I have wasted so much time thinking about it. And I've decided that's not the point. It's not like, oh, we have to find the mind that does the designation. Actually, if you read in my book, Appearance and Reality, I have like a collection of answers that I've gotten to that question from different teachers that are not the same as each other. But I think the right answer that I've gotten to is that's not what that means. It's not a question of like finding and positing when and in whose continuum the designating mind takes place. Okay. Oh, sorry. Sorry. One of my teachers told me that, like, okay, when you say that things are merely imputed by mind, it's a measure of how real they are, and it's not an invitation to go on a quest to find the designating mind. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. But now I think I do. And it's like, okay, to measure how real it means, it's like, it simply means that there is utterly nothing there on the side of the object that inner among or apart from the basis of designation that allows it to be that. It exists only as something that exists from the point of view of a certain consciousness. Well, let me just say one more thing. I can see what the time is, and there's a lot of very cool points in here. But yesterday we were talking, I just wanted to say something about the three truths. And it just really occurred to me that this reminded me of this, Mipham talks about that there's the ultimate truth and there's the conventional truth. And which one of these is more important? And he has this whole section on this. And he said, the final reality, the real nature, is this coalescence, this indivisible, primordially indivisible. We don't really have the right word.
Inseparable,
yeah, primordial, yeah, always, they always have been, always, they always, always, always already have been inseparable. Like, the problem with coalescence, it sounds like they were apart and then you put them together. That's the problem. And the same thing with fusion and all these kind of words. Yeah, this inseparable union is never has been separate, like primordially inseparable union of the two truths. Is that's the real nature, and it's neither of the two truths. That's what I'm saying. So it's like, it is very much like, in some ways, Jerry E's idea about a third truth, that you're alternating. We know, right, from studying the path structure, that it's like you realize emptiness, and then you come out of emptiness, and forms appear. And at least for a while, they have this illusory character because it's under the imprint of remembering that they're empty, but they're still appearing. And then at some point, the bodhisattva, meditates on emptiness again. But sometimes you're seeing emptiness, sometimes you're seeing conventional forms, even if those conventional forms are still like marked with emptiness. It's conventional. You're seeing not seeing emptiness and conventional at the same time. So you it's like alternating between the two truths. It's like you can't get them united into a single truth. And so what is the final reality of things? It's like when in Tsongkhapa's way, he says like, well, the final reality of things is emptiness. From a Nyingma point of view, and other people too, right? This does look nihilistic. Of course, their definition of emptiness, they think, is not, doesn't negate enough. But when they say, like, oh, you know, because you're not, as he said earlier, we don't really think you're understanding that you have to negate the actual thing in analysis, not just some inherent existence of the thing. But to say that emptiness is the final reality sounds negative because it leaves out the conventional, right? And so then you have this, it's like, well, how, you know, if the ultimate mind, you know, how does the ultimate not mind know conventionalities? And then Tsongkhapa has to, you know, have a way to treat that problem. In a way, you could say, like, it's a problem that's created when you insist on saying that the one of the two truths, and only that one, is the final and ultimate reality, right? And if, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, you can almost take Tsongkhapa's system and switch it around so that you can put this idea of coalescence into it. Do you know what I'm saying? And so you could say, well, yeah, you have to realize emptiness, that, but beyond that, the final nature of things is this union of appearances, which, you know, have a conventional basis and ultimate nature. And after all, that's why Buddha has two bodies. And of course, you know what I'm saying? It's like, the explanation is sort of given to you up front, because of course Tsongkhapa thinks that things, conventional things, exist, but you know, Buddha has this ultimate realization, and it's like, why do they, when you, this is very mysterious, it's like, why do they keep disappearing if they exist? Every time you realize the real nature, all these other existing things disappear. It's like, if you had the ultimate mind that was omniscient, you would think that, you know, it would see a real nature that would include everything, right? And so anyway, you can make that kind of like way of thinking about it and say, well, of course, the thing that is homologous to or functions as the equivalent of a third truth in Gelugpa is the Buddha's mind. You know, it's because it's not like the Arya's non-dual equipoise. It's the point where the illusory-like appearance of conventional phenomena in post-meditative state is not just fused with, but, you know, not fused with, but is simultaneously present without confusion with the, you know, equipoise on emptiness, right? Yeah, that's an interesting way. I never really thought about it. Like, Tsongkhapa doesn't, is really, you know, it's like we want to have all of these things in the Buddha's mind and keep them straight. We don't want them smooshed together and coalesced. We want, but it's like Buddha knows all the conventional things as conventional things and knows all the ultimate things as ultimate things. Isn't that interesting? That's sort of like, oh, well, that's what it means to look at the fruit from the point of view of the base. Do you know what I mean? This is the same equivalent of when we were talking about, oh, a person is directly non-dualistically realizing emptiness, and the Gelugpa is standing over here and saying, oh, that person has a mind realizing an object, emptiness, right? And it's sort of like discordant with the experience of the yogi, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, well, there's anyway, if you're interested, that's there's a lot more of interesting writing and stuck in the middle of this book by John Pettit called Beak Translation and Analysis of Nikon's Beacon of Certainty. But, that gives you more than a little bit of taste for. I think that there is definitely a growing appetite for Nipom and appreciation of what he accomplished.
Where was he? Where did he fit historically? I mean, in terms of what was happening, was he at a particular?
Well, he's part of the Rinne movement in eastern Tibet. So, I mean, he wasn't one of the founders. Like Zhangbong Kongtrul Lojer Tai was a co-founder, and a people associated. He was in the 19th century. I think that his dates are on there. So he's in 19th century Eastern Tibet. He's associated with and part of the Rinne movement. I didn't mention anything about Shendong, you know. But so I read this, especially the part I just read from Beacon of Certainty, as like criticizing Shendong, and so basically doing it, saying, you know, obviously Dolpopa's Shendong is really bad, and Tsongkhapa's way of doing things could be interpreted as being in its own way as bad or worse. And he uses the word Shendong to talk about that, what he's calling a wrong view. So, but there are, you can see what Nipom's doing. He's this combination of Madhyamaka and Dzogchen. for him, he does not foreground this concept of Shendong as something that is how he explains his view. He uses Madhyamaka, he uses Dharmakirti, and he especially uses Dzogchen. And he goes back and forth, you know, mixes it all together like that. But, so then people, like, because Shendong was very important in this Rime movement, and then a lot of, like, what's going on with Nyingma textbooks, you know, explaining things since then has based on Mipham. And so some people read Mipham in like a Shendong way, and some don't. But that's about that. Now we've come to the limit of my knowledge about that.